Good morning, Dr. Blaser.
Good morning to you.
Okay. Dr. Blaser is, of course, well known in the area of acoustics. He's one of the pioneers in the digital audio revolution. He received his bachelor, master's, and PhD degrees in electrical engineering from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he served for several years as an associate professor of electrical engineering and computer science, doing significant research in several aspects of signal processing. He also served as president and the governor of the Society of Audio Engineering, and he has contributed very much in this area. Throughout his career, Dr. Blaser has engaged in researching the experience of hearing space, as well as developing equipment to create a spatial experience for listeners. Many of his ideas found realization many years later. Recently, MIT Press published his book on Spaces Speak, Are You Listening? Experience Oral Architecture, which was awarded the Outstanding Academic Title for 2007 by the Associates of College and Research Library. His talk today will be an analysis of the oral experience of ancient spaces. We thank him very much for his participation in the conference using the modern technology that we have now. And the speech is now to Dr. Blaser.
Thank you very much, and I'm honored to be here, even if electronically. It's morning here in Boston. The title of my talk actually arose from the research I had been doing when we working on the book, and that's when I first came across acoustic archaeology. It became the foundation for oral architecture. But in doing that work, I was constantly struck by the question, how do we know what the experience of a space is? How do we interpret the measurements that we make? And that led me to the concept which I will be introducing here, which is called triangulation, which is you really don't understand an experience unless there are multiple independent ways of looking at it, all of which lead to the same conclusion. Slide 2, please. The question I asked myself is, what is acoustic archaeology? And I came to the conclusion it was really two completely different fields that were being integrated. It was the hard sciences in which we make physical measurements of spaces that still exist from the ancient past using modern technology and science. All of our modern knowledge is used in this activity, and we publish the kind of papers that might be found in any space. But there's also a soft sciences part in speculating why ancient cultures created their spaces and how they experienced them. This topic of the soft sciences also exists in modern spaces. Even in a concert hall, when you make measurements in it, there's a question of what do those measurements mean? And the idea that once you include people in your discussion, the name of the game changes. You can't use the same rules, paradigms, and approaches to understanding a people's experience as you can when you look at how something gets measured. Measurements have different rules than people experience, and we have to respect those differences if we're going to make sense out of this. Slide 3, please. Let's just take a quick look at modern acoustic science. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. There are thousands of new techniques and parameters that we can compute. There are very powerful computer tools that are inexpensive. We can simulate different kinds of environments. We can make models of them. But we still have two fundamental difficulties. What does the data actually mean? And in number 6 is one of the critical issues. Listeners are not interchangeable. So I can take a group of 30 people and have them listen, but each of those 30 people may be having a different experience. This differs from classical hard physics, because if I'm experimenting with an electron, all electrons are equal. It's not clear that people are equivalent, and in fact, the evidence strongly suggests people are definitely not equivalent. Slide 4, please. Just to take an extreme view of the hard sciences, I have a quotation from Lord Kelvin, And to some extent, most physical scientists believe in this. If you can't publish a number, you don't understand it. This opens the question, of course, is what do numbers mean? The belief is that numbers have meaning. Numbers may be accurate, they may be reliable, but you've got to give them a meaning in order to make sense out of it. But even in the hard sciences, you have to be very careful. And I'll give you one example of where the hard sciences will also fail. When you measure the impulse response of a concert hall, you believe, if you follow the rules of the assumptions in an impulse response, the numbers make sense. Turns out that in a real concert hall, there are thermal waves in the space because it's so large. That produces a time-varying quality. And one of the assumptions in an impulse response is linearity and time invariance. If I drop one of those assumptions, I may still get numbers and reliable data. It's not clear what the numbers mean. And in fact, Sabin, in the turn of the century, warned against such things as thermal waves. And in fact, the assumption of linearity also gets called into doubt. So ultimately, the hard scientists are faced with the same issues of the soft sciences. What assumptions are in there? How do you know if they're valid? And how do you actually reach a conclusion? Next slide, 5. The soft sciences have different rules. And I have a quotation which was attributed to Einstein but wasn't. He just posted a sign. Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. In other words, numbers are not necessarily the right answer when you're dealing with people. A social scientist, Austin Ranney, said, you've got to use hunch, wisdom, insight, instinct to make sense out of things, because there's no piece of equipment that'll tell you the meaning of a number. We humans have to supply meaningfulness. And if you look back at acoustic archaeology as a combination of human experience, why did people use the spaces the way they did? Why did they invent them? How did they invent them? What was the meaning of their experience in being in the spaces? That's a very different set of questions than the impulse response or the cross-correlation coefficient or some other numeric measure of a space that still exists. How do you put these two concepts together? That's a very challenging task, but we all have to face it, and we need to have a certain discipline, a kind of epistemology and a set of rules. How do we actually combine it? How do we make a statement? Over the years, I've had the opportunity to read numerous papers by colleagues in acoustic archaeology, and my sense is they really struggle with the conclusion. How do you actually make a conclusion when you've got so many unknowns, so many burdens to overcome, and what does the conclusion look like? My talk today is really going to address the question of how you make sense out of these ill-defined issues, and I hope we will have some kind of closure by the end. Okay, let's go to slide 6. Okay, experience is always private. This is one of the cardinal rules in working with human beings. If I put a piece of red cloth in front of everybody in the audience, we may all call it red, but we actually have no reason to believe the experience of red is the same. I can't read your mind. I can't get into your head to see what your experience is. I can ask you what color you call it, and you may call it red. But in fact, if you're seeing what I experience as blue, you will still call it red. You cannot read somebody else's mind in terms of experience. So how actually do you get a handle on what you're experiencing? Well, whether it's an ancient space or a modern space, an ancient human or a modern human, I've only found three ways in which you can get some sense out of the human experience. There is what I call introspective written and verbal reports. I tell you what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what I'm perceiving. I can talk about it. But that brings up the question of how accurate is language and how does language actually work in your brain in terms of having access to what's going on. If, for example, I ask you to report on your blood sugar level, you will fail. There is no connection between your language system and blood sugar that allows you to report that information. You just simply cannot tell me what your blood sugar is. The next way in which we get a handle on human experience is observed behavior. And this can be an individual's behavior, groups of individuals, or a whole culture. We can watch that how people behave. So going back to the blood sugar analogy, if I see that you are irritable and annoyed and not a happy person, I might conclude that you have low blood sugar. You might conclude that. But I'm only observing your behavior with a number of inferences. Now, the next item in the list of indirect access is a very modern activity, and it's quite exciting, and that's putting people willingly into scanners where you can actually see their brain activity in real time. And now for the first time, we begin to get a handle on seeing your internal mental response to a stimulus. You can see various brain substrates become active. You can see other areas suppressing activity. We're still left with the question in these brain scans, what is the subjective experience? I may see your prefrontal cortex become very active. I may see your amygdala become active. I may see all kinds of neurotransmitters floating around. I can see you're physically responding to some stimulus, but I'm still struggling with how do you give it meaning? How do you decide what that means? So how does we bring all this together? And item number 3 on the slide says, all the assertions in the end are really speculation. You cannot prove truth in any of these kinds of questions. This is not a mathematical proof where you can come to a conclusion. And even the hard sciences struggle with the concept of proof. You know, we may have been able to prove Newton's laws of physics, but we now know that's based on assumptions. If you change the assumptions, you come to different conclusions. What kind of language do we use to describe conclusions? Well, one of them is what I call the plausible explanation. And we can say it's plausible that. And yes, it is plausible, but plausibility is a weak conclusion. It may be the only conclusion we can come to, but it's still weak. And we have to respect the humility of these weak conclusions. It's plausible that I'm not really talking here, that I'm really a videotape recording, and I'm not alive right now. That's a plausible explanation. You can't prove it's not true. Hopefully it's not true, but there's no way you can make a proof. So what then are we left with? And the last item is the one that I like. If you begin to find universal patterns that cover large quantities of people and cultures and time periods, you begin to have a feeling that such patterns really are true. You cannot prove them. If, for example, we know that if people are not given water for 3 days, they die. And this is a universal pattern really having nothing to do with specific people. On the other hand, if you want to know how I experience enveloping reverberation, that may be unique to me. It may be unique to my background, to my culture. So we've got to look for what kinds of universal patterns are relevant. And we also have to look for, we also have to decide where we're going to go look for these patterns. Next slide, 5, 7. Okay, what are some of the universal patterns? Well, the first one comes out of sensory anthropology, and that's a wonderful little field. It's a fringe of anthropology, and it basically says that your sensory system, the properties of it do not arise from biology. They arise from the culture, how you use your senses, and each culture looks at them differently. Or in other words, hearing is more than just your ear. It comes about from how you use hearing in your day-to-day life. And the reason that culture influences your senses is brains are plastic. They used to think that children's brains changed until they were 15 and then they became solidified. We now know that your brain rewires itself as long as you're alive. And in this rewiring, it can use various brain resources for one purpose or another. Or in other words, if I exercise my brain doing certain kinds of tasks, it will borrow neural resources from other activities. And in some really extreme cases, you find certain kinds of blind people have in fact borrowed their visual brain and used it for their auditory system. Whereas somebody who doesn't use hearing very much might find that their auditory system is not decays and is used for other purposes. In other words, we are not a given element. We're flexible, fluid, And I would say that my brain and your brain are sufficiently different. Our experiences of different environments are going to be very, very different. We cannot make the assumption that two people with the same background are the same. And in fact, many sound tests that people do in experimentation, they'll say, I started with 20 students who had standard hearing. Well, that actually tells me nothing, because if one of those people was a musician, they might have an exquisite sense of pitch. If somebody else had been a night watchman, they'd be maybe listening for small sounds. A new mother might be very sensitive to the sounds of babies crying. These are rewirings, which means we're not equivalent. Item number three on this list is the humility of language. It turns out that language comes from one piece of your brain, and its ability to report an experience depends on connections between that piece of brain and another. Or in other words, if my language center and another piece of neural resource have no connection, you can't report in language what you're experiencing. You can experience something and have no ability to describe it. As you continue down with the neurobiology of recent periods, you begin to realize that certain functions which have similar words are really unrelated in the neural sense. Observing something and creating something are, in fact, different parts of your brain. You're not just a monolithic self. I can observe something which is sort of a perceptual system. Creating kind of means you synthesize an outside world that doesn't exist. The critical difference between observing and creating is observing is responding to something that exists. Creating is making something that didn't exist. These are very different types of activities. The next element is the importance of accidents, perceptual accidents, trial and error. We think we're logical and rational. In fact, most of our activities are sort of noticing accidents, perceptual accidents, physical accidents when they happen. And intentionality is, in fact, weak. And let me give you one sort of fragment from the neuroliterature. They were testing free will, and they asked subjects to decide when to do something and what to do. And they were running these experiments with people in these scanners, brain scanners. And what they discovered is your decision to actually do something took place unconsciously. Your sense of making a conscious decision was after the fact. In other words, your sense of choosing to do something is reporting what a piece of your brain had already decided to do. It was not deciding, but reporting that you decided. The actual decision was unconscious. I could keep going with the neurobiology, but this is really just an introduction that you've got to be very careful in what you think people are when you're doing experiments or making assertions. Okay, next slide, 8. I'm now going to get into case studies. I've selected a few case studies just to start illustrating some of the principles that might be relevant to acoustic archaeology, especially regarding conclusions. What kinds of cases have I selected? Well, I've tried to select them from a wide variety of cultures, sensory systems, events, because I want to convince you, maybe I will fail, that these patterns are far beyond simply acoustic archaeology. And I've chosen case studies where there's some secondary evidence. In other words, where I can begin the process of triangulation by saying, this conclusion is consistent with a social science view, it's consistent with a physical view, it's consistent with these other phenomena that I've observed. Consistency is the critical element that makes a plausible explanation more likely. So let's begin to look at some of these case studies. And this is probably one of the earliest ones that I've selected. On the left, we have pictures that appeared on the tops of bronze drums from the Han Dynasty. And these are interesting pictures. They certainly could be interpreted as having symbolic meaning. Certainly, Chinese scholars have been analyzing the Chinese musical instruments for years. And the question is, what did these symbols on the top of the drum mean? Well, it turns out an acoustic scientist in the 18th century observed that these patterns were very similar to the standing wave patterns on vibrating plates. So the left are the pictures on the drums. The right are the standing wave patterns you would get if you, in fact, tapped the drum or the plate, sprinkled some sand on it or some other dust, you would begin to see the vibrational patterns. And this then gives you an alternative explanation for what these pictures on the drum head were and raises an interesting question as to how did these Chinese craftsmen create such uniform, smooth resonances. And now we have a speculation, a new speculation, and that is, without understanding acoustics, without understanding physics, they simply observed that drum heads sounded mellow and resonant when the visual patterns were symmetric. Or in other words, another explanation for why these pictures appeared is they represented the methods by which the craftsmen created these uniform surfaces. Because, of course, in the ancient times, they would not have the access to modern tools in order to produce a uniform plate. They would need a very hands-on way of making sure the plate was smooth and uniform. And, of course, if it wasn't uniform, how would they know where to abrade and smooth out the inconsistency? Well, one theory might be they could use these visual patterns. Without actually understanding the meaning of these visual patterns, they still might, by trial and error, have discovered how powerful they were in creating a good quality musical resonance. Next slide, 10. Especially in this conference, and I probably will make a little bit of a fool of myself because obviously many of you know a lot more than I do about the acoustics of Greek amphitheaters. But there's one research paper by Shanklin that struck me as particularly interesting. He correlated that the acoustic quality of amphitheaters was connected to the visual sight lines. In other words, from his analysis, those theaters in which you could see well also had the better acoustics, which now raises the interesting question. Can we speculate that these theater spaces were designed with some intentionality of creating good acoustics? And certainly some theaters have better acoustics than others. Or can we produce the alternate explanation is that they had very little awareness of the acoustics. They simply wanted to make visual quality high up as being important. And just by accident, through correlation, those spaces that had good acoustics also had good sight lines. How would you distinguish between these two cases? Now, some people have argued, well, the ancient Greeks and Romans actually did understand sound, and now we have another critically important speculation. Just because some philosopher wrote in some treatise some discussion of sound does not actually imply that this information was part of the culture. It does not imply that the craftsmen understood this information. In fact, craftsmen were generally not literate, so we wouldn't have expected them to have read any of these documents. Vitruvius, who did some of the early classical work on spatial acoustics, the question for us is, who would have read it? The fact that we read it, the fact that we can go back and find some literature that's interesting, does not necessarily mean this knowledge was in the culture, where it was, who was using it. These are speculative inferences for which there may be no basis. Slide 11. Hearing and sight are very different in a lot of different respects. And I have this quotation up here about how difficult it has been over the centuries and still is to make sense out of hearing and sound. Sound is so abstract, it's very difficult to anybody to get their hands on. A visual representation is static. And I don't have time in this talk, but I will introduce one of the theses that I've been discussing in other lectures, and that is vision is for basically seeing the static objects in your environment, geometries and objects. Hearing is what I call for the eventscape. Hearing is detecting events that are taking place in the environment, because without much difficulty you can appreciate, you can't have sound without converting some kind of energy into sound energy. There's got to be a mechanical conversion process. Or in other words, sound can't exist without something happening. This happening is transient. It's not static. And so the importance of sound was very high in these older cultures because this was the primary way you could make contact with the events in your space. The importance of sound, however, also makes it one of the most difficult things to get your hands on because it just disappears. Sound incorporates time, and time is not a sensory system that works very well for humans. We don't have a good sense of time. So with this background, we're saying sound is very important, but not necessarily as part of your conscious life. Slide 12. Cathedral acoustics are very interesting because of their unique properties. And in this case, the literature is quite extensive on how cathedral acoustics came about. And as you follow this history, you begin to realize the acoustics were complete accidents. It started with the Greek open-air basilicas. Then they eventually put walls around them. They isolated them from the environment by making them an enclosed space. Because fire was a major issue with wood, when the technology got to the point where they could use stones, they began to make larger, bigger spaces. The weight would carry it. There was enormous amount of pressure to have spaces that could handle large congregations. The Catholicism was basically a mass type of religion where hundreds and thousands of people would congregate. Size was very important. When this whole process played out and you got the cathedral as a symbol of God's home, they just happened to be enormous. They happened to have no sound absorption. The volumes were very large. And as we now know, such spaces produce high reverberance. The religion then adapted to this spatial acoustics by having various kinds of music and liturgies which were consistent with high reverberant spaces. And eventually, the high reverberation became a symbol of God's home. So the process was backwards. In other words, the symbolic meaningfulness of being in a cathedral came long after these spaces existed. They were a reactive process, not a proactive process. We simply adapted. And this is one of the patterns that's going to show up throughout a study of history. Next slide. 13. We have a similar situation with the Shakespearean Globe theaters. There is enough history that you begin to see the same pattern taking place. These theaters started as bear baiting arenas. In other words, these were the spaces where they'd put animals in there watching them kill each other. And for some reason, they borrowed these spaces. Maybe there was one of these bear baiting arenas that wasn't being used, and a group of theater people came into the space and began to perform theaters. As they did so, they began to adapt to the acoustics of the space. They began to get comfortable. They modified their oration and how they spoke. They modified their movements. The plays that got written for such spaces were essentially adapting to the space. The stage had unique acoustic signatures, and the actors and audience recognized that these acoustics were unique. Not necessarily better or worse, but unique, and became a signature. And so these theater companies would literally take the stage with them because it was their personality, their signature. And we began to see acoustics became like a stage prop. But it started as an accident in this environment. And again, we see this sort of trial and error reactive process is the way in which these spaces came about. Slide 14. Again, we have supporting literature for how the Boston Symphony Hall was invented by Sabin in 1900. And this is particularly interesting because Sabin is considered the father of modern acoustics. But you have to look very carefully at what he did to really appreciate what it meant to use modern acoustics. In the handout that you'll get sometime later, there's a little bit more history. But basically, they decided to replace the Boston Music Hall with a new concert hall, and they wanted it to have the same sound as the concert hall in Leipzig, the Gewandhaus. Except for economic reasons, they said, don't copy this space. Don't replicate it. We want you to have 2,500 seats instead of 1,500. Make it 30% bigger. And Sabin's job was not to scale the space, but to replicate the acoustic parameters in a new spatial design, but copying the parameters. In other words, reverberation, time, early reflections. His job was to make it sound the same, but not to be the same because of the increase in size. But again, we see there's a replication element. He was not told to invent the parameters. He was not told decide what parameters are good or bad. He was told copy the parameters that exist in Leipzig. For better or worse, replicate them. You're allowed to invent a new geometry, new materials, new construction techniques, but don't invent a new sound. And so again, we see the replication element continues to appear. Okay, now let's switch gears. The next slide, I guess it's 15. This is a complete switch because we're not dealing with a space, we're dealing with an object. There was this 20th century Spanish architect who created this sculpture, which exists in Madrid. And it's a series of steel pipes, stainless steel pipes that glisten in the sun. This is still sitting there. And this was entirely designed to be an artistic expression. It was modern art. The curiosity part is some number of years later, a group of Spanish physicists who were working in crystallography wandered by and sort of observed that the structure of this object reminded them of the crystals they were working, and they speculated that this should become a sonic band gap which separated the various sonic frequencies in different ways and should have an interesting sound because by analogy they could guess what it would sound like by their experience with crystals. And so they went off and made some measurements and concluded that this sculpture was actually a multimedia sculpture. It had both very interesting sonic properties as well as the obvious visual properties. And now we can do an interesting mental game. Imagine a century from now, some acoustic archaeologist discovers this and decides it was a multimedia creation and that the acoustic properties that were in this creation were intentional. And wasn't Semper very creative to combine an oral and visual experience to come up with multimedia art? And that would be a perfectly plausible conclusion. There would be no way to prove it was wrong unless you had the history of how this came about and realized the acoustic properties was discovered after the fact by unrelated people in unrelated purposes. Now, you could certainly, having discovered it, put a sign on this saying multimedia sculpture. You could sort of invite listeners to hear the effect however much they could. They could admire the visual properties. But there was no way we could figure out how this came about without secondary evidence. And it's the secondary evidence which is always the critical element in supporting a conclusion. You can't speculate without going off into an imaginary guessing world without any evidence. Next slide, 16. This is back to the Boston Symphony Orchestra, because I happen to live in Boston and know something about it. And we had a very interesting experience about 10 years ago. The stage floor was completely worn out, and there was some suggestion that the way it was worn out was beginning to affect the acoustics that it had had when it was originally designed. And so they raised money to replace the floor. Now, you wouldn't think that would be an interesting challenge. But because Boston Symphony is probably one of the 10 best orchestra halls in the world, they said, whatever we do, we can't change the acoustics. And furthermore, we may actually have to change them a little bit because the wear and tear on the floor probably had an acoustic property. So let's return the floor to its original state. The way they did that was not by acoustics. They simply went back to their archives and tried to discover all the construction techniques that were used in making the floor. How did they select the wood? How did they dry the wood? What kinds of nails did they use? And in fact, they had the nails remade in the old style so that they were replicating the construction. They were not even attempting to replicate acoustic measurements. It was strictly a recipe. If we follow the recipe that the original construction people used, then we have some confidence that we will achieve what we want. But they didn't bother actually making a measurement because they had no idea what measurements to make, how similar they would have to be. And this gets back to one of the early slides. Unlike the 1950s, if you look through the acoustic literature, there are thousands of parameters you can measure. Which ones are interesting? How do you draw a conclusion from these numbers? How close is close enough? And in fact, in some studies, they find that a parameter can vary wildly. You know, it could have a value of 1 in one case and a value of 100 in another, and nobody can hear the difference. In other cases, they find that two cases which have the same parameter sound very different. In other words, even today, our confidence that we can connect parameters to experience is advancing, but still relatively weak. We are not electrons, and we can't pretend that we are. Slide 17. This now brings us to the hardest part of the talk. How do we start getting a handle on the nature of people? Because if we're going to talk about the human experience now or thousands of years ago, we can't avoid the question of who are we? What are people? How do we come to be what we are? What does it mean to be influenced by culture? How do we adapt? Who is the humanness that's sitting in these spaces? And unless you deal with this question, you can't make any sense out of acoustic archaeology, and you can't even make any sense out of modern acoustics or modern archaeology, because we're in it. We can't be taken out of it. So then we're faced with, okay, what kinds of properties about people are interesting? And of course, here too, we can do two classes of work. We can do what used to be called psychophysics. We can assume people are just like measurements, and we can subject them to stimuli and ask them to rate things. We can say, okay, I'm going to give you a range of sounds, rate them 1 to 10. Here's an example of 1. Here's an example of 10. Now put a number on it. We can do this experiment. We will often get reliable results. The question is, what does this mean? Furthermore, if we change who this experimental subjects are, we can change the result. So how do we draw a conclusion, and what are some of the global phenomena that we need to consider? So let's begin in the next slide. Back to, again, Boston Symphony, and I apologize for putting in a plug-in for the Symphony Hall, but I'm knowledgeable enough that I can recognize some of the patterns. The original concert hall in Boston was the Boston Music Hall, pictured on the left, and that was replaced by the new Boston Symphony Hall, the one modeled after the Leipzig Gewandhaus. The initial reaction to this new space by critics, the audience, the musicians, the conductor, everybody disliked the new space intensely. They hated it. It was criticized. There was an uproar in Boston by why did they take away our great concert hall, the Boston Music Hall, and replace it with this terrible alternative. If you then follow this process over the 3 or 4 years after the hall was first introduced, the attitude to the hall went from hostility to, well, it's not so bad. Well, some way it's good. I actually kind of like it. It's really nice. And eventually it became one of the classic halls in the world. Well, during this progression, the hall didn't change. They didn't redesign it. They didn't modify it. But the attitudes changed. So you find that as people become familiar with it, they began to like it. And this is one of the universal patterns, which is hard to accept if you haven't been into the cognitive science literature. One of the primary elements in quality is familiarity. And in this case, it took Boston listeners 3 or 4 years to become familiar with the sound of the new hall. Now, if you were to take the current generation of Boston audience and put them back in the original Boston Music Hall, I'm absolutely sure they would dislike it. The change is not welcome. And this is probably one of the most universal themes. So let me go on to slide 19. And you might consider this an odd topic to be in an acoustic archaeology conference. I happen to have had a personal contact with this in the 60s. A group of wine distributors in England had conspired to import table wine from Algeria and put it in bottles that were labeled as high-grade French wine. They charged the corresponding prices for it, and this went on for years. As a result of this, the public began to associate the taste of this wine as high-quality French wine. Some years later, when the scandal finally was uncovered, these wine distributors were sent to jail, and now real French wine was imported in the correct wine in the correct bottles. And the reaction of the drinking public was, what did you do with our high-quality French wine? Why did you take it away from us? And even though this was inexpensive table wine, their mental association with quality was so strong, it was familiar, that they wanted it to be brought back. And this pattern, which whether it's in the Boston Music Hall or Algerian wine, familiarity is very important. And even in our intellectual activities, we're familiar with certain ways of looking at things, and we really don't want to let go of something that's very familiar. If you're familiar with making measurements in the laboratory, you're just going to love to make measurements in the laboratory. If you're familiar with doing something a certain way, that to you becomes quality. And this familiarity actually is how culture gets propagated. We replicate something that's familiar. We teach our children to have these experiences. They grow up liking it, and they teach their children. And so you get a cultural progression. And I have no doubt that the familiarity with certain acoustic spaces was propagated through various cultures simply because it was familiar. And it doesn't have to have an intentional design like Semperer's statue. It was entirely an accident. But once it's integrated into the culture, it becomes accepted. Slide 20. Here's another quick little version of the same thing. Slonimsky did a study of what the public's reaction was to the most famous music, and in all of these cases, it was hated. The critics disliked all the famous musicians when they first produced novelty. Or in other words, novelty, even if we think we like it, is often disruptive emotionally, cognitively, and you get these vast outcries, don't change anything. And when you do, it produces negativity, and then eventually it follows the progression of familiarity. Okay, I'm going to try to leave time for questions, so let's keep going. Slide 21. Okay, so given this complexity, how do we speculate, and how do we make sense out of it? Well, the first task is if you're going to speculate, you have to be honest with yourself and come up with a multiplicity of plausible explanations. If you come up with one explanation just on the basis of one way of looking at something, there's no reason to believe it's true. On the other hand, if I take a given set of observations and I have half a dozen plausible explanations, all of which are different, I can begin to sort them into the likelihood of their being true on the basis of the extra information that's available. What do I know about the culture? What do I know about the visual arts? And the more secondary information you have, the more you can sort. Without other information, sorting is almost impossible. Okay, slide number 22. Just to really hammer this point home, I have here a picture of coins. And if I were to ask you, is this a random set of coins that might have appeared on a table when I poured them out of some vending machine? Or is this a carefully organized artistic display by some photographer who is trying to make a point? Now, both of these are plausible explanations. And I don't think you can tell. I don't think there's anything you can do, but you can cheat and lie with statistics. Now, I could do an analysis of the heads and tails and the patterns. I could come up with a theory and go off and conclude that these coins absolutely were arranged because it's very unlikely that I would have the coins in exactly this configuration with this group of nationalities and the heads showing the way they do. I can make up a theory and then said and prove that this is absolutely supports the theory. But this is one of the classic ways of cheating and lying with statistics. It's called the post hoc discovery of patterns from random events. Or in other words, every random event is unique. And in at least in the statistical literature, they call this data dredging. They say, let's take some data, and after the fact, let's figure out what it means. And you can always find a meaning. It's very unlikely that this pattern is random if you want to do an a priori thing. What's the probability this pattern would appear if I threw coins from a bag on the table? And the answer is very unlikely. But this pattern did exist and could have just been one of 10 million patterns that came out of throwing the coins on the table. So in other words, post hoc is one of the most dangerous ways of concluding something. But some intellectual disciplines have no choice. So, for example, evolution has no choice. You can't run an evolutionary experiment over the next 10 million years. So evolution, acoustic archaeology, and numerous other fields are burdened with post-hoc pattern discovery. And there's no way you can escape this. You can't go back and run an experiment in ancient Greece. Ancient Greece is history. And these are intellectual burdens that we must carry in trying to make conclusions. Next slide, 23. So let's bring my talk to a conclusion. What can we learn from this as applied to acoustic archaeology? What are the patterns? These are the patterns that I have observed in my research across all the cultures and all the evidence I could find. If I had to reduce my knowledge on the subject to 7 or so simple rules, here's what they would be. Social needs determine size of the audience. In other words, spaces are designed based on how many people you want to put in it. So if you've got an elite group of 15 people that attend the royal concerts, you're going to make a small space. You have large cathedrals with thousands, you're going to have a large space. That's intrinsic, and I'm going to argue the intentionality has to be on size of audience. The next part of it is building technology limits the size and geometry. You can't build spaces without the technology to support it. As technology evolves, the kinds of spaces, their geometries, the size of the objects changes. Once you go through this progression, acoustics comes out of these first three. The social needs, the building technology, and when you finally build the space, you have acoustics. There's no evidence that the acoustics were intentional. And just to do a quick digression, if you look carefully at the two words oralization and visualization, you'll notice they're actually not symmetric and not parallel. Visualization is mostly used to mean a mental activity. I can visualize what that building might look like. That's a statement you can hear from an architect. But oralize has come to mean to simulate a space with a piece of equipment, a spatial simulator. There never was any evidence that human beings could oralize an imaginary space. Now, in both cases, there's simulations. In one case, it's a mental simulation using a mental computer. In the other case, it's an external simulation using a silicon computer. They're both simulations. One is internal and one is external. There's no evidence that there's a symmetry. On the other hand, once you construct these spaces, listeners adapt to them. You get the familiarity, whether it's the bear-baiting arenas or the concert hall. You live in the space. Furthermore, in terms of experimenting with spaces, it's much easier to do experiments with musical instruments because the scale is small. I could, in fact, do 3 or 4 clarinets or drums and make them and sit there in my laboratory, hitting them one after another. I don't rely on acoustic memory when I'm comparing the sounds of 2 drums or 2 pianos. But I'm not going to do a new amphitheater in 15 minutes. I'm not going to compare them without burdening acoustic memory and going from one space to another. Until the 21st century, we could record them and do the oralizations. But certainly everybody in the past could not fiddle with an acoustic space the way they could fiddle with a musical instrument. 5, experience enhances subjective quality, and this is related to the adaptation. Future spaces are almost always replications of the earlier spaces, either an exact replication or, in the 20th century, a parametric replication. And the way these spaces evolved acoustically is by trial and error. I try this, I try that. And in the study of concert halls, there are thousands of really bad concert halls that have been torn down. The only ones that are left are survival of the fittest. And so these brilliant concert halls, these brilliant musical instruments, were not really designed. They're the ones that survived the Darwinian evolution of being acceptable. And there, too, the familiarity often breeds quality. And I hope I've convinced you that working with people is not the same as working with your equipment. And so I guess we have 8 or 9 minutes, and if there are any questions, I'd be delighted to entertain them.
Thank you, Professor Blesser, for your very interesting talk and the points that you raised. Of course, I believe that they will start some discussion. Let's see if there are some questions right now. Okay. You have to take this microphone because...
Hi, Barry. This is Jens Blauert. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. Good. It was a very interesting talk, and I may have to change mine tomorrow because many new ideas. But from a practical consultant point of view, if you had to build a concert hall, what would you do to make it better than the one that exists based on your knowledge and your intuition?
Well, let me answer that indirectly. If I had to design a new wine or a new apple cake, the quality is really a personal preference. And if you look back over the centuries, quality moves. It's not a static target. And the notion that there is a right concert hall, I'm not sure you can really accept that. Certainly for 19th century European romantic music, which was designed for certain kinds of concert halls, I would want to replicate the environment for that music, if for no other reason than the composers really wanted it to match that space. Or in other words, you could almost take the position that the concert hall was itself an extension of the musical instrument, and if I want to experience what they experience, I got to replicate it. But if I were to say to you, what's the ideal concert hall for the music of the 21st century, I'm not sure that's a scientific question. I'm not sure you can say what's the best concert hall. It's a preference. How could you prove which experience is better? I know I've avoided the question.
Okay, but you said one interesting thing. I mean, at the basis of your arguments, you say that preference is a measure of quality.
Preference is a measure of quality, but quality includes familiarity, and that's the circular trap. In other words, you can have a preference, and I have no doubt your preference for concert halls would be different than my son's preference for concert halls because he has weak familiarity with the classic halls. So if you say it's personal preference, but if preference has familiarity in it, you're in a circular world. How do you escape?
So if you want to create some... this one, is it? Okay. Post microphones, okay. good, yeah. So if you want to define quality on a more, let's say, inter-individual, more objective scale, would suitability or something like that be better than preference?
Yeah, let me go back again. If I take people your age and my age who've spent, you know, half a century listening to music and listening to classical European music in classical halls, I'm sure we would all agree on what quality is. And I'm sure we would all agree, given a particular music, what's the right amount of enveloping reverberation? How do you avoid it being too dry and brittle versus being too muddy? And I have a sense we could measure us and come up with very consistent results, but there's a lot of assumptions in there. The assumption is we're familiar with a certain kind of music, we're familiar with a certain kind of space, we've had a lot of experience, and we do have a sense of personal taste from lots of experience. But I doubt whether you'd get a consistent number from the 22-year-olds that my son hangs around with. I think it'd be all over the map. And I think in their case, you might actually find different definitions of quality. I just don't think they have the experience.
I agree with you. Thank you very much.
Some other question? Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
Basically, if I understood correctly, we have to be cautious, right?
Correct. Humility.
All right. Good. So how do you not paralyze from being cautious? How do we not become paralyzed by not daring?
Okay,
you have intimidated us with so many things that could go wrong because we are too subjective or because we have preferences. So how do you improve things? That's the question.
Well, the humility doesn't produce paralysis. Humility is humility. And what I'm going to argue is when it's possible, getting other points of view about the culture. So whether it's the Mayan constructs, the more you understand about their culture, their attitudes, the more likely you can raise a speculation from plausible to more likely. It's the secondary information that breaks the paralysis. Just by going into a space, if you drop me into some space with no context, no knowledge of it, and ask me, what did people 1,000 years ago experience, but I won't tell you who the people are, how they lived, what they did, it's a weak conclusion. But in a lot of cases, you can get secondary evidence. So in the case of the Chinese drums, it turns out because it was a literate culture, there's a large amount of secondary information from the craftsmen, from the attitudes towards pictures. You can build what I call a triangulation, which is multiple points of view. Of course, if there aren't multiple points of view available, you're limited. You can still speculate. You can still say it's a plausible explanation, but you can't really assert that it's likely. And so find as much secondary support as you can. But if you don't have it, how would you know? And I don't think the point of this talk is paralysis. I think there's a big difference between paralysis and humility.
Yeah, absolutely. But you see, you're talking about the past. I'm talking about the future.
The future of what?
I'm talking about the 21st century possible norm of a concert hall.
21st century, look, there's another. The ancient Greeks talked about what is the next generation coming to and they're destroying our culture. The fact of the matter, and again, if you go back to the cognitive sciences, the attitude towards how terrible the future is going to be is not a fair statement. And if you take one fragment of my talk, I talked about brain plasticity and the fact that your brain is the result of the culture you live in. Well, by definition, your children are growing up in a different culture than you are. They have to have different brains. They can't preserve the same quality definition, the same taste as you did. You grew up in a different culture. I'm the product of a 1950 culture. I grew up in that world. My children are a product of a 1990 culture. Their brains are literally wired differently. They can't preserve my cultural experience because it came out of a past that's gone. I don't think this is terrible. This is the human condition, and this has been going on for millions of years. Why should we think it's going to stop just because we want to preserve our culture?
It seems that there are no other questions, so I would like to thank again Dr. Blesser for his interesting talk. Greetings from Greece, and have a nice continuation of your day.
Thank you very much, and it was delightful being here. I have recorded this if anybody wants a copy of it.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.